Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome once again to another episode of So Married a Horror Fan. I'm one of your co-hosts, Simon.
I'm Lee.
And this is the final episode. It's the final countdown for March. Bit of March, bit of lovely little bit of March programming for
bit
you.
Bit of March.
We've got an Easter weekend at the end of this week.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah, then next week is going to be the 1st of
April. I've realised.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't done a full week at work now for about 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I've got a full week at work until, like, the second week of May.
Yeah, it's confusing. Like, it confuses me when they put Easter at the end of March. Because I'm so used to it being around your birthday.
Yeah.
And also, this forthcoming weekend, we get our daylight savings time. Easter Sunday is Daylight Savings Day.
Oh, is it?
We killed Jesus. Give us an extra hour of sleep.
I don't...
We killed Jesus. Take away an hour of sleep.
I don't know which way round it is.
So the Daylight Savings Time this time takes... The clocks go forward an hour.
So we gain an hour.
So we gain an hour of sleep.
Extra hour in bed.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah, brother.
Because Jesus is like, look, man, I need my cave. I need my cave time.
I need my cave sleep.
And then in October on... Whenever it is, we lose an hour. Take an hour back.
Oh, I hate when we lose an hour. It just makes me sad in my bones.
But it's already started to get lighter outside, which is nice. So
yeah, true that, true that.
But thank you, everyone, for sticking with us through this jam-packed month where we looked at The Wicker Man and Jaws and The Addams Family Values and Ghostbusters Frozen Empire and Death Note to varying different degrees. We are ending... our seasonal horror month with a look at a winter month, which will be The Shining.
It's so shiny.
If you've been paying attention to our socials, you also would have seen what's coming in April. If you hate any of the movies that were covered in April, blame Lee. If you hate any of the movies we're going to be covering in July, you could blame me. But how is it? I think this is the first time since we've been doing the podcast that we both have a five-week month this year.
We do. That is very true.
Yeah. I realised all of your films are, like, British productions.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Sure.
But, yeah. If you
are probably correct on that front, I think. I'm not sure one of them is. Because it's a Dean Devlin film.
Yeah, but it could have been filmed in, like, the UK. I'm talking about a film... I mean, a film can be, like, from an American company, but still be a UK production.
Oh.
Like, all of the Cornetto trilogy are Universal movies, but they're all British productions. Ah, the Cornetto trilogy.
We do love the Cornetto trilogy, which is true.
Which is a better alien invasion movie, though, featuring Nick Frost? Is it Attack the Block, World's End, or Paul?
Not seen Paul, so that's immediately discounted.
You've never seen Paul?
No.
No,
see,
Paul.
I love Attack the Block. So I feel like it's going to be Attack the Block, personally.
Which they're doing a sequel to.
I didn't hear this.
See,
I feel like you told me, in fact.
See, obviously, because we're covering it next month, I'm obviously going to have to rewatch it. But I remember watching it and just being like, I don't like this movie because I don't like any of the people in it. I just found all the characters to be really, like, fucking irritating.
I mean, that's fair.
It's pre-Star Wars John Boyega as well.
It is pre-Star Wars John Boyega.
Pre-Doctor Who Jodie Whittaker.
It is indeed.
And just pre-anything else Nick Frost. Well, it's pre-World's End Nick Frost. So he did this before World's End.
Yeah.
But
after
yeah.
Paul?
No, Paul's kind of in the middle. So I think Attack the Block was 2010, Paul's 2011, World's End's 2013?
Sure. You were just saying numbers at me now, buddy.
So if we're covering Attack the Block, does that mean we could cover the World's End? If you consider Attack the Block a horror movie...
I mean, it's not even so much that I consider it a horror movie, it is that it is classed as a horror movie.
Yeah, but I'd be interested to know, before we get into this, let us know on social media what you guys think. Do you consider Attack the Block a horror movie? Do you consider The World's End a horror movie?
I mean, I can still change it, so...
I'm just saying. I
haven't recorded the episode
No, 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 no. I'm not asking for it to be changed. I'm intrigued as to, like, what people... Because there's so many movies like this where people... Like, I see people cover movies on podcasts. Like, I saw a bunch of people cover Cocaine Bear when Cocaine Bear came out. Because they said Cocaine Bear was a horror movie. And they were like, yeah, if you consider Jaws a horror movie, Cocaine Bear is a horror movie. And I'm like, you have a point.
You make a point. I don't like that there's a point there, but you make it.
But yeah, it's weird. Like, I think it's all subjective. I think it depends on, like, what people... Like, I guess to a degree, like... Attack of the Block would be like a horror sci-fi film. Although weirdly, I find the kids to be scarier in Attack of the Block, because I think it's because we live in the UK and kids like that
do exist.
Are prevalent, mate. There's a few of them that live on our street.
Nah, those lads are always really nice. Whenever I run into them, they tell you, well, they were fixing one of their mopeds on out front of the house not that long ago.
No.
And I like cut the road. They were all gathered around it, like a little rat pack of fucking attempting to fix this moped. And I was walking up the road, and literally, I was like, oh, for fuck's sake, I have to cross the road. Little fucking dickheads. Oh, my God. And literally, they saw me coming. They all jumped back and like, oh, really sorry, lady. And I was like, all right, fucking chill out, lads.
Mate, you say fixing one of their mopeds. I say scrapping a moped for parts that they've just robbed from someone.
Well, maybe.
Which is an indication of how we both view the world. I think that's an indication of how we both see things.
I was really intrigued as to what they were doing. And I have a feeling, you know, someone's walking past and they were saying something. I think they were trying to figure out how to change the oil.
Nice.
And I was like, I could have done it for them, but you know, I'm leaving it. I ain't doing that.
Now that I think about it, though, do you, like, this will be the last thing I say on this before we, because obviously we are going to cover it. Is Attack the Block filmed in the same block of flats that is used in Shaun of the Dead?
No.
Huh.
No. I can't remember where it's filmed, but no, it's different block of flats.
Because it's Joe Cornish who made it, isn't it, from the Adam and Joe show?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, we're not talking about that movie. We're talking about that movie in a couple of weeks. In fact, I think, because we have to tell people what we're covering in the next episode at the end of this one, I think Attack the Block is the next episode that we are covering. I think it's the next thing we are covering. But
anyway. And now you've ordered things, so...
Anyway. Today we're talking about The Shining.
The Shining.
From 1980.
Duh.
Not 1997. So, you got all the information in front of you.
I do indeed. First of all, yawn. As is a requirement whenever we get to this. So, yeah, The Shining from 1980.
Said that.
Written by Stephen King, allegedly, Stanley Kubrick and Diane Johnson. Directed by Stanley Kubrick. Cast-wise, you've got Jack Nicholson as Jack Torrance. They really worked hard. There. Shea Duvall as Wendy Torrance, Danny Lloyd as Danny. Is he called Danny in the book?
Yeah.
Oh, this was just sheer lucky casting, right, okay.
Also, I find it really funny that the actor who plays him is called Danny Lloyd, and there's two characters in the movie called Danny and Lloyd.
Yes, there is. Scatman Crothers as Halloran. He's not the Scatman. I was going to say. Barry Nelson as Ullman. Philip Stone as Grady. Joe Turkle as Lloyd. And realistically, I think that's kind of it.
Outside of the girls.
Yeah, and then there's Lisa Burns and Louise Burns as the Grady twins.
Who I don't think are actual twins.
They are sisters.
Yeah, but I don't think they're actually that. Twins in real life.
Well, they were both born in 1968, so I think they in fact are.
Oh, maybe.
I'm just double check. Yeah, they're both born in 1968.
I mean,
unless one was born like at the very beginning of the year, yeah. One was born at the very end, it's more like most likely that they are twins.
I was going to say, like, you could have a baby in January and get pregnant in like February again and then have another baby in like fucking November. It seems unlikely, but stranger things have happened.
I'm just having a look, see if there's anything about
them. I mean, in fairness, they probably are twins. For some reason, I didn't think they were, though.
I think it's because one of them looks like they are actually older.
Yeah. I thought it was like a Harry Potter situation where the two twins and that weren't actually twins and they met at the audition. And then they got cast as twins because they looked alike.
That literally always makes me howl. I've seen that movie. I've seen that interview so many times and it always makes me laugh. There's literally a post here from the New York Times. 2 years ago. The Shining twins, Lisa and Louise Burns, pay respects to the Queen. They came to the UK to look at her corpse.
Come and play with us, Liz, forever and ever.
And like, come and play with us, Liz. Apparently they are, in fact, actually twins.
Oh, speaking of royal mysteries, there was a picture of Kate Middleton online today with her three kids for Mother's Day.
Ah.
I've just given a game away how long ago was we actually recorded this episode prior to it coming out.
Yes, indeed. Here they are, all grown up.
Yeah, they appear at, like, they do, like, cons and stuff together, which I think is really cool.
Aww, that's sweet. But yeah, so they are actually twins.
That's cool.
As far as we can figure out.
Identical screams from room 217.
Exactly. But I do kind of think that's really it, casting-wise. There's not really anyone else who, like, plays a major part in the film.
Unless you count the Stanley Hotel from Colorado.
Indeed. So this was made on a budget of $19 million estimated, and it made $47,328,250 at the box office. That was a lot of numbers. Mm-hmm. Right, plot line wise. So a family heads to an isolated hotel for the winter, where a sinister presence influences the father into violence, while his psychic son sees horrific foreboding from. English. A family head to an isolated hotel for the winter where a sinister presence influences the father into violence, while his psychic son sees horrific forebodings from both past and future. There we fucking go. That is really horribly written. I don't like how it's worded at all, but that's the plot line for this film.
Based on the third novel by Stephen King.
Is it his third novel?
Third novel after Carrie and Salem's Lot. It's also his first novel to be released in hardback. And it was released in 1977, 3 years prior to the film coming out. And it was also released the same year that his son, Owen, was born.
Joe.
No, we determined that Joe was born in 1972, Owen was born in 77. We had this conversation earlier. Because we said Joe inspired Danny in the book, not Owen.
But he would have released it before Owen was born.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is the book came out in 77, the same year that Owen was born. Okay. That's what I'm saying. Like.
Sure.
But, yeah, so Stephen King actually did write a version of this script, which Stanley Kubrick threw in the bin, very famously. And it is one of the adaptations of his work that Stephen King has the most disdain for. Even now, he took a dig at it, at Stanley Kubrick's adaptation of this in the book The Outsider, which came out in 2018. And it's one that he's very... He hated the adaptation of this film so much that him and his good friend and frequent collaborator Mick Garris actually went and did a TV miniseries version of this film in 1997, which yields more closely to the book. But we were talking.
Always intrigued with Stephen King adaptations. Obviously, like, he's well renowned. He doesn't like this, but I'm like, there's got to be other adaptations that he doesn't like, and my brain automatically will always flick to Haven,
Dark Tower.
Dark Tower, but Haven, because Haven is loosely based on the Colorado Kid. And we say loosely because they take the plot line of Colorado Kid and went, yeah, that happened in Haven at some point. Mm-hmm. And some of the characters, like the newspaper guys, are in the show. But literally, when it was coming out, it was like, from the mind of Stephen King, Haven. And I was like, this has nothing to do with the Colorado Kid book whatsoever.
I think Stephen King's a very interesting one because it's very obvious which filmmakers do hold him and his work in high regard and which directors and filmmakers, like, consult with him and, like, have a reverence for his work. One of them is Mike Flanagan, who is currently on his third Stephen King adaptation. He obviously made the sequel to this, which we will be discussing at some point later this year. And then, obviously, he did Gerald's Game and he did Life of Chuck, which is... in pre-production, post-production currently. But then there's a lot of adaptations of his work, things like Running Man, which is based on a Richard Bachman story, Lawnmower Man, same situation, where they basically use the title and the very, very loose concept, and then they do their own thing with it.
Because so, Under the Dome is based on a Stephen King book as well, is it? Which is also a sci-fi TV show.
Yes. So I think it's an interesting one. Obviously, it's one of those things, whenever an adaptation of his work comes out, everybody always tries to get the soundbite of, have you seen it? What did you think? Blah, blah, blah. And sometimes he's more favourable than others. Like, there have been times when he doesn't really talk about, like, adaptations. And the thing is, as well, I think what a lot of people have to realise is, he's such a prolific writer, and a lot of his stuff, when he was hot in, like, the 70s and the 80s, a lot of his stuff was being adapted into films that had, like, a lot of his work is, like, quite high concept.
Mm.
So they were adapting things in his works in an era when they didn't really have the money for the special effects or money to do, like, big elaborate sets or things like that. So I think a lot of the stuff that comes out now, like, post-millennium, he tends to speak more favourably on, because we now are in an age where we can have the technology to actually, like, pull off a lot more of his elaborate stuff. And audiences are conditioned to watch, like, an audience will be conditioned to watch, like, a 10-episode TV series or, like, a 3-hour film, because of how long summer blockbusters and stuff are now. You can actually make a film that's longer and more considered and consider more of, like, the actual works and things like that. And I think we're now in a generation of, like, filmmakers that were reading his books in, like, the 70s and 80s as teenagers who are now making films, and therefore they have a better grasp on his work than what people did at the time. I mean, you think about this. This was always going to be, like, a mismatch of styles. This film comes out 3 years after the book, and Stanley Kubrick, you know, very famously directed Lolita prior to this and A Clockwork Orange, both of which deviate from their source novels. Clockwork Orange, I'm not entirely sure how much of it deviates from the source novel.
I don't think it deviates hugely, that way.
Because I've only ever seen it once and I'll never watch it again.
I need to rewatch it. I bought it on Blu-ray recently, and I know you hate it, but I do hold that film in some reverence.
But, yeah, so it's kind of interesting, like, so I'll start with you, obviously, as the Stephen King aficionado. You are going to hear a lot of my thoughts on this very, very later on. But, like,
I thought you were calling me the Stephen King aficionado, no. And I was like, I think there's some mix-up there.
I think for you, this film must be like a lot of other films that we've covered of a certain vintage, where it's so, like, The Exorcist, for example, like, Alien, like, Evil Dead, where it's so, like, in the pop culture lexicon, you must have seen so many scenes from this movie out of context, and then seen it become, like, this pop culture juggernaut where it's, like, parodied on The Simpsons and SNL and, like, band merchandise and referenced in songs and music videos and, like, other media without actually ever seeing the film. So, first off, tell me what your, like, relationship to this material is prior to us watching it, and obviously how having all of those things through pop culture in the back of your mind while watching this influenced your first viewing of this film.
So, The Shining is one of those films that I think I've always been vaguely aware of, just because it's The Shining.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And obviously, like, a lot of stuff I've seen has referenced it in some way, shape or form. It's become massively memeable. I use a GIF from this at least once a month. For any girls, I feel like they'll know exactly what I'm referencing.
Yes.
Because I'll text it to you.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things that's kind of always been in my psyche to a degree. Like, I knew exactly who the Grady twins were. I know the Danny can play with us and the Red Rum. Because it's all just, it exists in the world and it is very famous in the world and everyone references it constantly. I feel like watching it didn't really affect my viewing all that much or influence my viewing, because I don't think it's ever been hugely referenced in anything that I'm, like, really into.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. Like, it's not something that's, like, been hugely referenced in, like, films and shows that, like, I watch regularly that are, like, I'm a really big fan of. So I don't think it really affected how I watched the film in any way, shape or form.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just think it's one of those films, like, I think some of the, like, more iconic scenes are, like, you know, out of context when you see them in this. It takes away some of their impact.
Mm.
Like, every time I see the scene with the elevator with the blood, I always think of the episode of The Simpsons where they do the shin-in. And it's like, oh, that's weird. The blood usually gets off at the third floor. Like, I always think of that. Mm. Or, like, you know...
See, I'm not a huge Simpsons fan, so...
You know, like, now I always think of, like... There's, like, certain specific things that I always think about when I watch this movie. Like, the 30 Seconds to Mars video, obviously... Yes,
the kill video.
Yeah, where he's doing the scene with the ball bouncing against the wall. Or, like, when he walks past the hotel room and you see the dog guy giving the other guy the blowjob, which is obviously a reference in this as well. And then, obviously, the most recent thing that, obviously, I always look to for a frame of reference is the Ice Nine Kill song, Enjoy Your Slay.
Mm-hmm.
Which...
I really love that song.
Which, considering it's on an album, they chose to do it on the film album rather than the book album, the lyrics of the song actually reference both the novel and the film, because there's a lyric where he says identical scream from 217. Obviously in the book the room is 217, whereas in the film it's room 237.
Mm.
So there's like little references to the book.
I feel like it was more of a, we ran out of space on the book album and I really yeah. wanted to do a Shining song, so we'll have it on the film album.
Yeah, because they a little side note, they had written the song prior when they were touring Every Trick in the Book, because I saw them about 9 to 10 months before Silver Scream came out. And it was the only song from that album they'd played on the previous touring cycle, because they played it when I saw them. So I do wonder if that is right, if they'd written it and then moved it over, because they'd like it was like a B-side.
Someone messaged Pennywise and asked him.
So, but and that song features Stanley Kubrick's grandson, Sam Kubrick, on it, which I think is really interesting as well. So going into this, like, obviously... For any long-term listeners of the podcast, you will know that this is one of only two films in the world that genuinely scares me. Like, there are films that I watch that gross me out, that make me feel uncomfortable, that I'll never watch again because of content. But this is one of the two films that genuinely actually frightens me. One of which is The Exorcist, which we've already covered. We covered a couple of years ago. And then this is the other one.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen this movie in over a decade. Because I genuinely don't like watching it. Like,
and then I was like, babe, wanna cover it?
Yeah. I was like, of all the Stephen King things that you could have chosen to cover, because this movie always just puts me in like a really odd mood after I've seen it.
Mm.
But what was your first impressions like watching the film? Like, what made you want to pick it in the first place? Is it just so you could fuck with me?
Surprisingly, no. So I think it's one of those things where it's become so referenced, and I really do love the Ice Nine Kill song, I'm not going to lie to you. Enjoy Your Slay is a fucking great song. And I kind of, we've watched a lot of, like, horror documentaries and, like, stuff like that over the recent years, and it's one of those films that always comes up.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I've never seen it. Like, I never had an inkling to watch it. And I was like, in all honesty, it's probably one of the only Stephen King adaptations that I might possibly enjoy. Because I quite like a very, like, cerebral, like, is it real, isn't it, psychological horror film.
Mm-hmm.
You know how I feel about stuff. I love films like that. I really make you think about what's happening. And it's, like, really psychological. It probably, like, worms its way into your brain. So I did think, I was like, it's probably going to be the only one of the only Stephen King adaptations that I'm going to, like, honestly quite enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's why I picked it.
And what did you think of it?
So I set my expectations way too high for this movie. And I think all we have learned in recent months is that I do not like films that were filmed in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
70s, 80s. This is
well,
this 80.
Came out in 80, yeah. But like, it would have been made in the 70s.
70s, early 80s films and me do not jive. I find them dreadfully slow. and not slow for like a good reason. Like, I don't mind a film if it's slowly paced because they're really building to like a big like psychological fuck up. I love shit like that. But this film, it kind of goes, oh, this is Jack and his wife and his son, and look, oh, they're a nice happy family. Maybe, possibly, something happened, maybe. Oh, look, they're having a nice time. Oh, no, yeah, Jack's insane.
Yeah.
And if there's no build up to him gradually getting worse, it is just, oh, Jack's insane.
Yeah.
Which really annoys me, because I'm like, what would have been great was for things to start happening around the hotel that we weren't entirely sure what was happening, but Jack was, like, slowly losing it. Especially with how long this film is. They could have done a quite a slow burn psychological breakdown to him being in, like, where we end up in this film. Because a massive chunk of this film, like, all of the bits I knew, so, like, the maze scene, the Here's Johnny scene, the I'm not gonna kill you, I'm not gonna hurt you, I'm just gonna bash your brains in, all happened at the end of this film.
Mm-hmm.
It's all in like the last 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Legitimately, it's the last 20 minutes of this film. The death of the other guy, the other Shining guy.
Yeah.
I can't remember what his name is now. Oh, Scatman.
Yeah. Ski ba ba ba
ba.
Ski ba ba ba. His name is Dick Halloran.
Dick. Love it. All of that happens in like the last 20 minutes of the film. And I am like, for the other hour and 40 minutes of this movie, because it's a nearly 2 hour long film, it basically is 20 minutes of them just being like a regular normalish family, and then Jack goes insane.
Yeah.
And there's no slow build up, it's just Jack is off his rocker, but not in like a fun way of like, oh, is he actually, or is it, well, it seems that way because his wife thinks he's going insane, when in actual fact that's what Jack's always been like.
Mm-hmm.
No, we are basically straight up told there is something wrong with Jack about 20 minutes into this movie. And I would have much preferred, because we're told as well at the very beginning of the film that there is going to be nobody else here.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
except Dick Halloran, who's just randomly there.
Yeah, well, he's not though, because he goes home.
Oh yeah, he does,
because he has to get a flight back to the hotel. We're told there will be nobody else here. It's just going to be you, your wife, and your son. And then the bartender's there.
Mm-hmm.
Old Lloyd. And the woman in room 237. And the Grady twins pop up. And I'm like, it would have been better if they'd said, oh, most of the staff are leaving, but people might be coming back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Or just not address the rest of the staff. Because then, when like the barman shows up, or the Grady twins, you don't instantly go, oh, so they're not there then. They're not real, or they're not actually human beings. Because you'd have also had that moment of being like, hang on a second. Are you real? Do you exist? Or are you in Jack's head? Or are you in Danny's head? Like, are you real people? Also, the Grady twins make no sense being there.
Mm-hmm.
Because I assumed from like all of the clips I've seen and stuff, and people talk about the Grady twins with like this reverent tone, as if like they're really integral to the plot. They're really not. They're just two ghosts that fuck with Danny a little bit. And part of me is like, are they trying to hurt Danny? Or are they just, they're just kids who have been trapped in this hotel because of what their father did, and they literally just want a friend.
So,
but I do feel like a lot of this stuff was answered in Stephen King's novel.
So, yeah. This is, I mean, we may as well just start talking about the book alongside the film.
Please do, because I feel like a lot of my anger at this film is because of the stuff they cut out of the book.
So basically, Stephen King wrote this book in the middle of his alcoholism. And he wrote two books, which were centred in Maine, Carrie and Salem's Lot. And then he decided that he wanted to take a break. And like, he was like, for my next novel, he's like, I'll set it somewhere else, I'll go somewhere else, and kind of try to change the vibe. So him and Tabitha actually went to the Stanley Hotel, which is where the film is shot, and basically lived like Jack and Wendy did. They were like, yeah, we went there for a few months. Like, we were the only two people there. Like, it was really spooky. Like, and he's like, one night I had a dream about my son being chased by a fire hose that had come alive down, like running down the halls of the
overlook.
And he's like, by that point, I'd woken up and like I had the bones of what the story would be. And it's in the book, Jack Torrance's character is more of like, he is a man who is like succumbing to alcoholism, and like he is abusive. Like in the book, he breaks Danny's arm, which he kind of they make a vague reference.
They vaguely reference it, yeah.
And then like, you know, it's kind of that slow descent. But the main thing, and this is the thing that I think is why a lot of the film doesn't really make sense, is because in the book, the Overlook is actually more of like a malevolent presence.
It's an actual character, yeah. Instead of just being a setting.
So you know like how in The House on Haunted Hill, the really cool 1999 film with like fucking all the cool people in it that we covered. Mm. The house is like alive and yeah, the ghost yeah. to like... So it's kind of like that. Like, you know, the book itself was inspired by things like The Haunting of Hill House, The Fall of the House of Usher, things like that. Stephen King's actually cited those as references. And it's more about... So basically, Danny has The Shining, which is a psychic ability. And so in the book, the ghosts want him because they want to take his ability in order for, like, the house to be able to spread its evil further. Like, because they can use his, like, telepathic powers to get into people's minds and, like, spread that evil further. But he's too strong, or they can't break him down. Which is why they force Jack to do it. So that Jack kills him so that they can then take his power like that way. Mm-hmm. So they and there's a lot more of them like enticing Jack and basically like slowly turning him. And like, I think if I remember correctly, I think the Grady twins died because they all like, it's a similar situation.
They
like,
also the
they
shining.
Find families with people that have the shine in them, lure like a member of that family to the house, to the hotel. And then they force them to kill, like, you know, and then they discard of the other person when they don't need them, essentially. And, like, the hotel and the ghosts and that whole story plays more of a part. Mm. Whereas, like, Stanley Kubrick just went, nah, fuck that, mate. He's like, I don't want any of that. And that's what I said to you. I was like, there's scenes in this movie, like, if you notice, any time that Jack is talking to a ghost, he's looking into a reflective surface. Except for the scene where he's in the food store talking to Mr. Grady and you see him off screen. And that's because he can see him in the metal door reflection of the like food store. But like when he's talking to Lloyd, he's looking in the bar mirror. When he's talking to Mr. Grady in the toilet, he's looking in the mirror. So it's all of these like ideas of like looking at yourself in the mirror, like facing up to your own demons. Like, are you having that conversation with yourself and are the demons in your head? Like, and you're projecting those voices yeah. as, like, actual beings, yeah. or it's are just, you actually
I do feel like
ghost?
It's not very well done in the film.
Yeah,
whatsoever.
And that's why I think, like I said to you, there, like, the scene where he walks into, like, about halfway through the film, when he walks into the bar, and all of the guests are there, and, like, Lloyd says to him, like, you know, your drink is on the house, like, it's courtesy of the house, and he says, well, I would like to know who bought me a drink. And I'm like, if you have that information in your head, or if you're kind of like piecing the film together as you go along, that's the film's way of telling you the ghosts are getting desperate. They need this to happen. So they're buying him drinks to try and push him over that edge to make him more susceptible, make him weaker, so that they can get him to like kill the family.
Yeah, because I think this is a massive problem with this movie, is they don't really explain The Shining at all.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a conversation that happens between Dick and Danny, Dick and Doc.
Yeah.
Very early in the film where he's, like, asking, like, oh, like, do you know what it is? Do you know why you can hear me?
Yeah.
And Danny is like, I can't what his friend is called or what
Tony.
His name is Sherry oh. Shining. Tony. He says, like, oh, Tony told me not to tell anybody. But then Tony's never really fucking explained.
So,
who the fuck is... Like, this
so
is the
this
problem
is the
is
other
there's
thing.
So many loose ends yeah. of, like, who, what?
So, in the, this is another thing that Kubrick went, nah. In the book... Tony is short for Anthony,
yeah.
which is Danny's middle name. So Danny's name is Danny Anthony Torrance. Tony is the adult version of Danny from the future, communicating with him in the past via The Shine, trying to warn him of the atrocities that are going to happen so that he can get the family out of the house. Which again is in the book, it's explained. It's basically the older version of himself trying to... That's why Danny's and like Wendy are trying to get Jack out of the house. And that's why Danny keeps having the visions. Because it's kind of explained as, like, he has these visions or these forebodings. But, like, as Dick says in the book, he's, like, they're more classed as, like, psychic photographs. So they're kind of, like, versions of events that have happened. And like, Tony, quote-unquote Tony, is sending him that information back to be, like, we lived through this, but this is like, we need to stop, almost, like, stop this. So that's kind of why Tony is communicating with him, and that's why Tony says to him, like, you know, about, at the beginning when he's like, oh, do you think he's going to get the job? And he's like, oh, he's already got it. He's about to phone Wendy in a couple of minutes. And when he says, oh, you're not supposed to tell anyone, because it's that link between the younger and older. But again, Kubrick just went, nah, and fucked it all off. And this is why, like, Stephen King basically went, this is not an adaptation of my work. This is, like, a Cliff Notes version of my work. And I've always been super intrigued as to why Stanley Kubrick took this job on. And obviously there's a lot of stuff that we'll talk about in a little bit as to what this movie is or isn't actually about. But he basically just took the very, very loose idea and then told, like, his own story.
Yeah, and I find it really annoying with some of those, because I do feel like The Shining is probably one of Stephen King's most personal novels, because it's the story of a father and a son, a father who is succumbing to alcoholism, mm-hmm. who is, I think in the beginning of the film as well, is quite afraid of the person he is becoming, mm-hmm. and whether or not he's a good father, and whether or not, because there is this scene between him and Danny where he's actually holding on to Danny, saying, like, you know, I love you.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is Stephen King addressing his own fears at being a father, especially a father who was in the throes of alcoholism, mm-hmm. and, like, making John, no, what is his name?
Joe.
No? No, not his son. The character in this.
Oh, Danny.
No, the adult. Jack. There we go. Thank you. Making Jack a writer as well. Like a...
Yeah.
I want to say a wannabe writer. I don't think he's actually a published author. Like, I feel like he took on a lot of mannerisms of King himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I do feel like this is probably, more than likely, one of his most personal books. Because it addresses something that I feel like a lot of men go through anyway, regardless of whether they're not an alcoholic staying in a haunted hotel, is that fear of becoming a father, and whether or not you're doing a good job, whether or not your child loves you back, whether or not you are the kind of parent you want to be, and whether you're doing right by your child.
Yeah, and I think it's also, like, the demonization of yourself through your children's eyes in relation to your actions.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, there's literally the scene that precedes that, where he sat on the bed and Danny, like, walks past and then stops and freezes and says to him, oh, is it okay for me to go and get the fire truck out of the bedroom? So there's always a sense in this movie that Danny's kind of maybe a little bit afraid of him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as we find out through watching the film, we know that obviously, you know, Danny threw his papers down, and he tried to, like, get the papers up and pick Danny up, and that's when he injured him. And he's like, you know, my wife will never let me forget it. And you get the sense that maybe that was the catalyst potentially for what set him off on this. Like,
I feel like he was already, because the thing is by the point of the film, it kind of feels like he is in recovery when the film begins.
Yeah.
And it says that as he starts to slowly go off the rails, the alcoholism plays a big part in that. But I do feel like that was the incident that stopped him drinking originally.
Yeah.
And he's been trying to make up for that ever since.
Yeah, but I think that's maybe the inciting incident that caused the strain between him and Wendy's relationship, mm-hmm. that's explored, like, later on in the film. But yeah, it's such a fascinating... And, like, the thing is as well, like, in the book, obviously, Jack is a more layered character. But do you know, the most interesting, and I think to some degree, egregious changes are the ones that have become the most iconic. So in the book, there is no elevator of blood. There is no maze. There is no all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy. There is no axe through the door scene.
There's Johnny. Yep,
that scene's not in there.
Why does he say Johnny?
It's a Johnny Carson reference.
Oh, I don't know.
And also, the Grady twins aren't present. So all of those things that people are now, like, synonymise this movie with, None of that is in the original novel. So in the original novel, it's hedge animals that look... So there's like hedge animals, like topiary animals that sit outside of the hotel that come alive and at various different points in the book attack Danny and attack Jack instead of the maze.
Oh.
There's a scene where, like I mentioned before, the like fire hose comes alive and he actually doesn't kill Dick in the book either. He beats him with a croquet mallet or a roque mallet, but he survives. Whereas in this, he just straight up murders him. And they are like the biggest, outside of the fundamental stripping away of what the story actually is, they are the biggest changes to like the actual book and the film, which is kind of amazing, really, because it's like, it's so crazy to me. Like, we always talk on this podcast about mandala effects and things that people think happened and didn't happen and how adaptations create new lore for things. And it is genuinely insane to me to think that, like, you know, everything that people find iconic about this film are, like, completely, like, from the imagination of Stanley Kubrick.
Mm.
And it's mad that... And I guess to some degree, over the years, that must be, I guess, one of the things that sticks in Stephen King's side is that, like, all of the things that, like, people reference or... You know, because you imagine people fucking must go up to him on the street and be like, come and play with me, or, like, here's Johnny and all that shit. Like, people must do that, like, when they see him. But, like, he's like, that's not me. Like, I didn't create any of this shit. So I think that must fuel his fire for, like, the hatred of this film. But, like, I've always found this movie to be quite terrifying. I remember seeing this movie as a child when I was probably about 13 or 14. I had a slightly psychotic friend who I went to school with who was obsessed with this fucking film.
Mm.
And I remember him making me watch it and just being like, from those opening, that opening music, that brum, 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 just being like, nah, dog, I'm out. And like, I think there are some genuinely like well-executed scares in this movie. Like, I think, like we were talking about at the beginning of this episode, I think it's subjective as to whether people would call it a horror movie or not.
Mm.
It's kind of in that Silence of the Lambs vein of, like, is it a psychological thriller? Is it a horror movie?
We've had this conversation earlier before, haven't we? I honestly don't think the thriller genre actually exists.
Yeah, but, like, so... okay, would you call it a psychological drama or a horror? Like, because there's obviously, like, a psychological element to it, but we're dealing with ghosts and things like that. There is a supernatural element to it. But like, I think in the last decade since I last saw this movie, the last time I saw this movie was when I was getting, without going to, was getting my life together and overcoming a period of alcoholism in my life. So it took on a whole completely different meaning rewatching it through that lens. But from a, like, obviously I know that there are lots of this film that you found to be quite boring, but from a, I guess this is a two-pronged question. First and foremost, can you understand why this movie is regarded as a classic and why it's held up over the test of time and is so revered today? And was there anything about this film outside of the performances, which we'll talk about in a moment, that you actually did like?
We'll go to the second question first, just to muddle things up. I like the last 20 minutes. I think the main scene is really well executed.
Who does it better, him or Spielberg?
What?
Because Spielberg does it in Ready Player One.
I forgot about that.
He does that scene and he does the Room 237 scene.
Yeah, I forgot about that. I quite like the maze segment. I think that's really well done. But I think most of the film, realistically and quite honestly, I just don't get it.
Yeah.
I don't understand why this film is held in such, like, high regard and is so revered. Because I don't know if it's just me that, like, maybe I missed something.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Maybe I missed something that really makes this film, like, dig itself into people. But I don't get it. I don't think it's well-paced. I don't think it's well thought through. I think there's some great set pieces. I think the location they found was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's some great set pieces, but I do feel like they missed everything that could have made this film legitimately a great movie.
Yeah.
Like, there's for me personally, with a film like this, it should have been a slow burn. And I feel like Stephen King's book is very much a slow burn. Like, it all happens very gradually. Whereas I feel like this film, it kind of happens and then nothing.
Yeah.
For ages. And then, oh, here's the end of the movie. Whoa!
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But to be fair, I'm trying to think of what Kubrick's work I've seen. I've seen Clockwork Orange, obviously.
AI is the other one.
AI. But AI is 50-50. It's Kubrick and Spielberg.
It's 95% Spielberg, 5% Kubrick.
Exactly. Yeah. So I don't think that really counts.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen Clockwork Orange probably since I was about 16, 17 years old. So it's been a very long slog of me not seeing Clockwork Orange. So I can't remember what the pacing in that is like.
Yeah.
But I don't know if maybe it's just a Kubrick thing where he's like, ha! Okay, now we're just going to pretend nothing happened for like 3 hours. And at the end it'll hit you. I do need to rewatch Clockwork Orange because it may just be a Kubrick thing. And I may be holding Clockwork Orange in this regard. It doesn't actually deserve years down the line. But yeah, I don't get it. But I honestly think part of it is the time period in which this was made.
Mm-hmm.
If we've learned anything, horror movies from this era, it's not really for me.
Yeah.
But no, I just don't get it.
I also wonder as well, like, one of the big changes, and I don't know if this would make sense to you, I guess, but in the book, obviously there's a whole subplot about the boiler being, like, rotated and turned and stuff like that. And obviously, like, because he mentions at the beginning that he needs to, like, turn the boiler to, like, heat different rooms for different parts.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, like, a bigger plot point. Now, in the book and in the miniseries, Jack is able to come to, and just as the boiler's about to blow, like, the house, the hotel blows up, and he dies. He dies in a blaze. The ghost, the hotel, and him all go in, like, a fire. Now, I've heard people say that gives him too much of a hero's death. Now, obviously, the roles are slightly different in the book because Wendy's character in the book and the miniseries is more of a protective mother who will do anything. She's a fighter. She fights back. She's resourceful. She's...
Oh, don't get...
Yeah.
We're not even getting started on Wendy because I have so many issues with her.
This is what I was about to say, was like, I think Kubrick makes Jack more villainous, but in doing so, minimizes and reduces Wendy's character. Stephen King turned around and said it was the most misogynistic portrayal of a female character that he'd ever seen on film
at that point.
And he was like, I cannot believe that he took my character and reduced her to that.
There's literally, when we were watching it, there's literally the sequence after she finds the playmate Jack Dunbar. First and foremost, about 30 pages into that, you could just guess that they're probably all going to say, work and no playmate Jack and Doll Boy. You could probably stop and start backing the fuck out of the room. Also, she's holding a baseball bat. She waits until after the iconic, I'm not going to hurt you, I'm just going to blow smash your brains in line, before she starts trying to hit him. I'm not being funny. I would have fucking swung from the minute he started being fucking... If you did that to me, if we were, like, in a abandoned hotel in the middle of nowhere and you started behaving like that, you were coming at me and I was holding a baseball bat, I would fucking bash your brains in. Mm. It'd be an immediate reaction. Like, it's not even like it would be a thought process. It would be, I have heavy objects, you are coming towards me, smash, 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 smash. Like, it wouldn't even be a thought process. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, it would just be a genuine reaction. And I feel like most women, that would be a genuine reaction of just, like, I swing heavy object down.
Yeah.
Like, in that kind of really, like, I swing it. It's bash, bash, bash.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I would probably also make the bash, bash, bash noises as I did it, because I have no control over those kind of noises. But I do it in the car. I go, round corners.
But I've never understood the need for him to ramp up the idea of Jack as a villain. Because, yeah, okay, like, Jack's a shit person. But you have to understand he's also someone who is dealing with, like, a heavy addiction. I was like, he's not an out-and-out villain. I think he's a more layered, morally grey character than what Kubrick makes him out to be.
Morally grey, but I think that's a big problem with this, is because I feel like with Stephen King's book, there is a line. I haven't read the book. I'm going on vaguely what I know of King of the North. There is a line where you question it of going, is he being haunted or is it his addiction?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At no point in this film did I think, Is he not? Like, I'm not even kidding. Up until you told me he was an alcoholic, I had no idea his character was an alcoholic. Because they never address it. They never mention it. Nothing. And it's not even like he has a moment of guilt when he's drinking in the bar and's like, I really shouldn't be doing this. He just goes straight into drinking. Yeah. Like, there's nothing in this film that makes my brain go, oh, he's an alcoholic. Right, okay, that's important information. I will lock that down. Because I do feel like with the King novel, there is probably that line that is drawn at some point where you go, hang on, is this actually happening?
Yeah.
Or is this just his alcoholism taking him down a dark path?
Yeah.
That's completely missing from this. Yeah, up until you told me that he was an alcoholic, I had no fucking clue he was an alcoholic.
Yeah. But I don't understand why he decides to make Jack an out-and-out villainous, like, evil, from the get-go character, and then in doing so minimises Wendy's role. There's no reason why he couldn't, like, Jack's portrayal could still be exactly the same in the film. If that's how Kubrick wanted to write him, and if that's how Kubrick wanted to portray him, there's absolutely no way or no reason for him to have then made Wendy the way that she is and completely go again. And, like, don't get me wrong, it's a fucking amazing, like, Shelley Duvall is amazing in this film. It's just that you find yourself irritated with the character because she's reduced to being a helpless wreck for no reason.
Well, this is the thing, because, like, I was thinking afterwards about the scene that I referenced where she's holding the baseball bat and Jack is basically not chasing after her, but basically stalking her through the reception hall. And that would have been so easy for him to start moving towards her and her to swing at him.
Yeah.
And him jump back. And not only, I think, would that have made it slightly more, because then she's, like, actively, and then, like, her backing up, like, repeatedly swinging, trying to keep him away from her. The same line delivered while she's doing that and he's grinning manically, being like, I'm not going to hurt you.
Yeah.
That would have been, A, way more terrifying to me. Because I feel like at that point you kind of go, he's not scared of me. Like, I currently have a weapon. I'm physically trying to hurt him. He's not scared. He's just, he finds the whole situation hilarious.
Yeah, but also as well, like,
but do you know what I mean? Like, think about that sequence, but how I just described it. That is more scary to me than her just whimpering, backing up a flight of stairs.
The thing is as well, it's not even like it's a sudden switch. She's like passive and submissive throughout the entire film.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like,
the, like, only time she takes any kind of stance is when she thinks that Jack is the one who has strangled Danny.
Yeah.
And that is it. And all she does is shout at him and then run off crying, holding Danny.
That's what made me think, because there's the line after that when he's talking to the bartender, that's what made me think that that incident with Danny previously, 3 years before, was what caused him to start drinking. Because he says, that bitch will never let me, or, like, I can't remember the exact line, but he's like, that bitch will never let me, like, live that moment down.
I think it's the other way. I think that's the incident that stopped him drinking originally.
It's like, I mean, it's open to interpretation. It's one or the other. Like, it's either one or the other. I think it's just, it's how you read the situation. But, like, there's no reason, if you've seen your husband, like, battling with alcoholism, if you've seen him, like, hurt your child in a fit of alcohol-induced rage or, like a moment of mania, there's no reason that I could see, and I say this as someone who's never really been in this situation, so I might be speaking out of turn, and I don't want to minimise victim trauma, but there is no way that you would be that passive and submissive around him and still making excuses for his behavior even when he's sober. Like, there is something I think that would potentially, like, make you more protective of your son and give you a slightly harder edge, unless the reason why she is being passive is because she is making herself smaller in order to not set him off and not incur his wrath. Hard to read the way that the script is written.
This is the problem as well, is because there's scenes in this movie, like, at the very beginning, where, like, they're laughing and joking, and, like, a fucking, he makes a cannibalism joke.
Yeah.
And then he's like, I know what cannibalism is.
I've seen it on the TV.
See, he's seen it on the TV.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So it kind of feels like it started getting her shit together. But one thing that really gets me with that scene where she's like, you did this to him. You have come running from another room where Jack is asleep at the table having a nightmare, where you're then trying to comfort him. Danny comes from a completely opposite part of the hotel, and you're like, you did this to him. I'd be more like, you're here. I was over there.
Yeah.
Who the fuck has her ass up?
But then, like, also, like, 10, 15 minutes later, she goes, oh, yeah, it was a woman in a room who strangled him. And I'm like, so you've gone from, like, blaming your husband...
And she doesn't apologise. Yeah,
who would have to have fucking teleported in order to, like, Homer Simpson your kid, to then being like, oh, no, it was potentially someone else who's here that we haven't seen this whole time who strangled him and Danny told me. And I'm like, so you believe that your son was killed or strangled by a phantom of someone who wasn't supposed to be there, but you don't take the time to ask him that question before you accuse your husband of doing it. Her character is so... And, like, the thing is, knowing what we know
the
about...
The thing is, as well, is I would get it if she, like... If she heard a scream or a noise and then found Jack, like, heading back towards that direction, I would fully get her reaction.
Yeah.
But he's asleep at his desk where he's been all fucking day.
Yeah.
Like...
And the thing is, as well, like, knowing what we know now about the relationship with Shelley Duvall and Stanley Kubrick on set... And how tumultuous and, strained that relationship was. To the point where she, like, they were fucking screaming at each other and stuff. Obviously, in later years, she's kind of said, like, you know, I understand why he was that way. But at the time, he nearly drove her to a fucking nervous breakdown. And you kind of sit there and go, you've got this character written this way. But then you're also punishing the fucking actress... It's like almost like life imitating art in a sort of weird way.
Yeah,
and it's very uncomfortable watching her performance knowing that. Because you're almost like, there's almost like scenes where you're like, Jack Torrance's character in this is a conduit for how Kubrick was treating her in real life. And it gets very uncomfortable in like specific moments.
Yeah.
So outside of obviously what we've already discussed, did you have any more sort of thoughts on...
I have some more nitpicks. Yes, I do.
Go on then.
Major question, how fucking long does it take for anybody to get anywhere in this film? So, right, we know that Halloran is back home. Wherever home is, I know he has to drive, get a snowplow to get to the Overlook.
Yeah.
Right? He's on a plane at one point. So when he's still at home,
mm-hmm.
at his own house, he calls the police. And he's all like, I can't get a hold of the Overlook. And I really need to speak to them. And it's really super fucking important. Like, can you try and contact them? Yeah, Brian, no problem. I totally got this. Don't worry. Hangs up. I think then we don't see them try and contact the Overlook until he's on the plane. Which has got to be at least a solid 4 hours later.
Well, it also depends on where he is. Because he could just be, like, in a neighbouring state. And
he's got to get on a plane. It's unlikely. Yeah. You just drive from a neighbouring state.
Yeah, but it might just be easier to, like...
But even then, so we're talking maybe, like, an hour drive to the airport.
Yeah.
This is America. Probably a minimum an hour flight. But I think he's way further away than an hour flight. And then he's got to drive through the snow to wherever the fuck he picks up that snow tractor from.
Mm.
And that snow tractor does not drive fast. He's then got to drive all the way back up that fucking mountain in the snow tractor to the hotel. So his entire time period, I'm giving him a minimum of maybe 8 hours. Bare minimum. I guarantee you it was something more like 15 to 20. But we'll call it 8. Okay. And today, we don't see them probably try to contact them until they're on the flight. And Jack pulls the thing out of the radio. Also, A, why has Wendy not been checking up on this radio? Because the cops told her,
also,
keep it plugged in, so like if anything does happen, we can contact you.
Also, I would assume that it's not a commercial flight, because they've already been told that the phones are knocked out due to the storm. So I'm accounting for the fact that he doesn't live that far away, and they potentially have some kind of like...
Well, no, because he's on a passenger flight.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
Because he's literally sat next to somebody on the plane.
Yeah, I was just thinking in my head, like, now that you've said it, but I was just thinking, I was trying to give the screenwriter, Mr. Kubrick, some fucking leeway to be like, oh, maybe they've got, like, a plane that they use to get the staff in and out. But maybe you're right.
I'm just trying to see if there's anywhere... I mean, somebody's literally made an entire subreddit about it. There's a lot of scenes featuring him making his way to the hotel, but I don't know if... Yeah, no one seems to know how far he travels, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's like when we talked about Halloween H2O, and it was like Michael Myers' fucking drive from, like, Chicago to California.
Yeah, but, so the cops are trying to radio through, they can't get a hold of them. Jack takes the adapter out of
the radio.
And all my brain could think was, no, police show up.
Mm-hmm.
No, none of the police in that police station think, it's really odd we cannot get a hold of anyone. Especially bearing in mind what happened last year.
Yeah.
With the fucking massacre.
How has this hotel not been shut down?
Well, exactly. But also, the year before, the caretaker they hired for the summer with his wife and two daughters went on a rampage, murdered his kids, his wife, and then himself.
Yeah.
And none of the police go... You know what?
Hang on. Now that I'm thinking about it, though, do you think that the people that own it are, like, actually real? Or do you think they're ghosts? Because, like, that... Now that you've mentioned that, like, I've never, ever considered that when I've watched a film. So, obviously, like, yeah, this scene...
I feel like they have to be, only because we see him interacting with other staff members, and we see the owner interact with Halloran.
Yeah, and he interacts with Wendy.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like... I don't... See, part of me now, because it's been a while since I've read the book as well, part of me is now wondering if the people that own the hotel, maybe if they're not ghosts, if they're, like, under the control of the Overlook, and that's why, like...
I feel like the only problem you come up with that is Halloran.
Yeah.
Because I feel like...
But Halloran's...
He'd have known.
But then maybe Halloran's, like... a guard. He's there to, like, help the people. Like, he's like a guardian angel almost. But, like, yeah, there's no reason why this hotel should be still running if they keep having massacres year after year.
Mm. Well, I mean, regardless of that, though, you'd think the police are like, okay, so the dude called, he said it's really important he gets a hold of them, and then they can't get a hold of anyone at the Overlook. Like, my first process would be like, do we remember what happened last year?
Yeah.
Does any of us think it might be smart? Just hear me out on this, because it sounds insane. We go and check on the family in the murder hotel.
Yeah.
Anybody? Raise a hand if you... No hands. You're all fine with there potentially being another murder.
Yeah.
Okay, well, just stay here. Because, like, the police will have access to, like, snowplows and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, fucking Halloran manages to get his hands on a snow tractor.
And, like, at no point does, like... And this is another thing as well that makes me, now that you've said it, wonder if, like, the owner, like, Ullman and that lot, are, like, under the fucking hotel's control. Because at no point do any of them respond to this. Nobody tries to get a hold of any of them.
No.
And I do wonder now that you've said it, if they are under the hotel's control... And then they're like, they just lure people there, and then they're like, hey man, you're on your own, like Homer in a hedge. As a theory I've never heard before.
Also, other question, while we're on this front, why has Halloran never had any issues at the Overlook?
Yeah.
He also has The Shining.
Yeah, but his shine might not be as strong as Danny's because he's older.
But I do feel like the hotel doesn't really care that much. They just need shine.
Yeah, but it depends because, like, in Doctor Sleep, they reference, like, different levels of shine.
Mm.
So, like, Abra and Danny are, like, adult Danny and Doctor Sleep, and Abra, like, have, like, a really potent, really strong...
But what I'm saying is
he might not be enough... For power for them.
But
to,
I do,
like...
feel like, irregardless, the hotel would have tried to kill him.
Yeah.
Because even that little bit... Because I'm assuming in some way it works to kind of keep them powered up.
Yeah.
So even... It's like being hungry. I'd prefer to have a Sunday roast, but if I have to, I'll eat a chocolate bar. Just to keep me going for a little bit.
But you know what? Fuck you, because Stanley Kubrick said so. Like...
Well, fuck you. Because I don't care what Stanley Kubrick said. But, like, do you know what I mean? Like, this has so much... But, like, yeah, like, why do the police not show up? B, why after what happened last year. Mm-hmm. Because the thing is you must have to get a sign off from like insurance and shit to have three people staying at your hotel in off season taking care of it. Like that's got to go on the insurance. Why did none of the insurance go, you know what happened last year? Do you think maybe we just hire some professionals?
Yeah.
And like a bigger group. And maybe do it so they come up and down the mountain. So a group are there for a week and then they go back down and a new group come up. So many things don't make fucking sense.
Mm-hmm.
And the longer I'm thinking about it, the more things I'm going, that doesn't make any sense. That doesn't make any sense.
Do you know what, though? Do you know, it's mad that we're sitting here having this conversation about parts of the film that don't make sense. Whereas there are, like, these aren't even, like, surface-level things that people think about when they talk about. The cult surrounding this movie is fucking ridiculous, and what this movie may or may not be about. Like, as a film and as an adaptation of, like, The Shining, it's not a great adaptation of The Shining.
No.
It's a great film in its own right. Like, if Stanley Kubrick had called this Crazy Hotel Murder Man, like, it would be a much, like, better film.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, watching the Room 237 documentary, the mythologizing and, like, reverence that people want to make this film more than what it is. Rather than just looking at this film as like an exploration of like the supernatural and like demons real and imagined and alcoholism and like parental studies and like even like at its basest edge or urge, when it like when he says like, you know, I signed a contract, I am responsible, I cannot fail, like even looking at it through the lens of like a man and like a man's responsibility at that time in history to his family as a provider and as somebody that, like, needs to, like, be the person who puts food on their table and, like, needs to be seen to be, like, the patriarch of a family. Like, which is kind of, like, referenced a few times in this film when he's talking about the idea of, like, I have a contract, I have a word to keep, like, you're not going to ruin this for me. Like, even looking at those things, like, as a basis for this film and what this film's about. So if you watch The Room 2, like, I'm going to run the four theories by you that are in the Room 237 documentary.
Okay, can I pick which one's my favourite?
Yeah, if you want to. But okay. I also kind of, like, let me go through them all first.
Okay.
And then we will, like, I'll get your opinions on what you think about them.
Okay.
So the first theory is,
I feel like I should have, like, a notebook or and like I, a thing.
And need. I will kind of explain to you how the people get, like, to this theory.
Okay.
So, like, the first theory is that this film is actually about the genocide of Native Americans in America.
It's on an ancient burial ground.
So, yeah, there's the whole thing about the Stanley Hotel being buried on an ancient... on a burial ground. But then also, like, there's the reference on the poster about the shocking wave of terror that is sweeping America that was on the poster for the American version of the film before it came out in the UK. And then in the film, like, and I didn't want to point this out to you because I didn't want to put any of these things in your head until we'd watched the film. But the first time you see Halloran in the food store and he's talking to Wendy and Danny, there is a, like a canister, like a can on the side that says Calumet on it. And it's got a Native American on it. And I can't remember what's in the actual can. It's like a food product. But that in Native American means like peace pipe. And there's a whole thing about like that shows up at that point when you first see it. And the guy who's talking about it makes a reference of like Kubrick puts it face on so you can see it. You can clearly see the Native American. You can clearly... That is a correct... I'm using the correct terminology. Native American. And you can clearly see the word. If you know what it means, like you know the reference to the word, then there's obviously the reference about the shocking wave of terror sweeping America. If you look throughout the Overlook Hotel, there are many pictures in the film of Native Americans on the walls. And there's also, towards the later part of the film, when he's having the conversation with Mr. Grady off screen, you can see the cans behind him of the same product, but they're all turned different ways. And he's talking about like how he doesn't have the courage to go through with what needs to be done and the execution. And like, he's essentially putting it as like somebody having a conversation about committing this genocide and killing these people, but not being a, like, not being strong enough to do it. And none of them are really telling the truth. And then that's why all the cans are all sort of slightly different ways. So the first theory is that this movie is actually Stanley Kubrick's, like, feelings on, like, the genocide of the white, like, the white man's genocide of the Native Americans.
Oh, mate, I felt like some reaching. Because so, I just want to point out before we go any further, because I feel like I need to say this now, otherwise I won't forget. Calumet's a baking powder company.
Yeah. But it also means, like...
No, I know. It has, like, an actual meaning in...
baking powder, that's what it is. That's what
but it's
it
literally, like, a... It's an actual product. Yeah. It's a company that's still going to this day. They make baking powder.
And the guy who says it was like, I can't believe that I'm the only person who thought this when I came out of the film. So
I feel like he's, you know, Charlie in... show with the thing.
Always Sunny,
The theory board, I feel like that is this person.
So the second theory is that it is about the Apollo 11 moon landing.
Oh no, skip straight over that.
No. I wanna present the workings.
Okay.
So basically there is a theory that this movie is about Stanley Kubrick faking the moon landing. Like basically Stanley Kubrick helped to film the moon landing.
I'm aware of it.
Can you just let me
No, carry on, please.
So basically, there's apparently a bunch of different references in this movie. So Danny wears a jumper with Apollo 11 on it.
He does.
The famous Overlook carpet, the iconic one, is apparently designed to look like the landing bay where Apollo 11 would have gone from. There's also they said that they changed the room number from 217 to 237. The practical reason is because there was actually a room 217 in the hotel, and they didn't want people to be afraid to use that room when using the actual hotel. But apparently the theory is that it's 2037 miles or something, like whatever the number is, it's 237 miles from Earth to the moon, like in millions or thousands or whatever that metric would be, which is why he changed the room number to 237. And then obviously the bit about him saying, I have a contract, I have a duty to uphold, is apparently a dialogue that Kubrick wrote to be like, I signed this NDA to say that I was going to like do this footage. And like, this is a secret that I have kept and you don't understand how hard it's been for me to keep this secret. And apparently there's like, if you watch the film very specifically, there are like layered over shots that kind of show footage that back up this claim. So that's the second theory, that it's all about the faked moon landing.
Okay.
The third theory is that the maze in the film is a reference to Minotaur. This is a very flimsy one. So Stanley Kubrick released a film called Killer's Kiss, which was released on Minotaur Films or Minotaur Productions or something.
Yeah, sure.
And basically the reason why he put the maze in the film is to tell the story of the Minotaur and the maze. And it's all about, like, it's a thinly veiled way of him telling that story inside of this story, which is obviously, again, we watched a video about Saltburn where they referenced that in Saltburn about the Minotaur and the maze. And obviously that's the reason why he put the hedge maze in the film as opposed to the topiary animals. Rather than it being a special effects reason, it was that he wanted to tell his version of the Minotaur and the maze through the prism of this work inside of this film.
Mm-hmm.
And the third one, the fourth one, is by far, I think, the craziest. And I think probably of all of them, the one that I kind of had never heard before.
Okay.
But again, it's something that you really have to break down the film to kind of like really consider. So bear with me, because this is a very like crazy one. So Stanley Kubrick was working on a film called The Aryan Papers, which was about the Holocaust, which he had been working on at the time. And then eventually it was one of his like career films, and he ditched it when he found out that Spielberg was doing Schindler's List. So there is a theory that there are parts of this film that are about the Holocaust and the genocide of the Jewish people. And he makes a lot of different references to that in this film, apparently. So the first thing that they mention is the fact that the number 42 appears. The number 42 appears several times in the film, whether it be on like Danny's jumper or like in other parts of the film. Now, they obviously mention the fact that the typewriter that Jack uses is a German typewriter. And they were like, with Kubrick, nothing is by accident in his films. Like, everything, like every colour, every choice, everything in a frame is designed to mean something. And they were like, there would be no reason for there to be a German typewriter unless it was very specific. So they were like, 1942 is the year that the Nazis decided to carry out the Holocaust and the genocide of the Jewish people. So they were like, you couple the number 42 with the German typewriter. He's like, also, the elevator of blood is meant to symbolise all of the blood that was shed during this time period.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, but what he's basically saying is that when he mentions, like, Danny's visions and things like that, and the photographs that Danny has in his mind, he's like, what Kubrick is presenting through his use of this iconography is that he is essentially asking his audience subliminally to accept the horrors of the Holocaust, but to let them go. And he is using this imagery to kind of basically make a statement on the Holocaust. And also there's a scene in this film where if you play it parallel, frontwards and backwards, they're talking about Danny's death in this, which is kind of like supposed to be representative of this statement also. So yeah, that's your four theories. One is that it's about the Holocaust. One is that it's about the Minotaur and the Maze. One is that it's about the faked Apollo 11 moon landing. And one is about the genocide of the Native American people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I think is very interesting about all of this is at no point watching any of this film did any of those things, even with that knowledge in my head and the number of times I've seen this, did any of those things ever become apparent to me? And I think the part of the reason, like, I don't understand what it is about this film that has made people watch it and produce all of these different theories and make this film more revered and reverent, like referenced and mythologized than it actually is, because they go, oh, it's about this, it's about that, it's about this, or it's just a very, very loose, poor adaptation of a novel that came out 3 years prior to it. So I'd be very interested to kind of get your take on any of those theories, whether you think any of them hold weight, and where you really think any of them would have come from. Because I don't think you could talk about this film without talking about
I think is it's a reach. I think the main point of their whole thing is like, oh, the baking powder.
Yeah.
And I'm like, or alternatively, it's just the baking powder on a shelf. And more than likely was faced out with like a direct shot because it was in fact product placement.
Yeah.
There we go. That's that explained away. The moon landing one, I've heard the theory that the moon landing was faked and it was filmed by fucking... I don't know how they decided that it was him who filmed it, why it was Kubrick specifically, but I feel like him wearing the Apollo 11 jumper, because I even caught that. I feel like that is a nod to the fact that people think he faked the moon landing. I don't think it's him going, oh, it's all true. I think it's him going, you know, everyone thinks I faked the moon landing. Put him in an Apollo 11 jumper because that would be fucking hilarious.
Hmm.
The fucking conspiracy theories, people will lose their minds. Which, let's be honest, I don't know much about Kubrick, but I feel like anybody who has that kind of conspiracy theory about them would do something like that just to fuck with people. Which I think explains that one. The Holocaust one, again, I feel like it's just people reaching for stuff. I think it's quite easy, like, if you have a theory in your brain, what is it called? A confirmation bias?
Yeah.
Where you will then pick things out and go, oh, it's clearly referencing this. But that's because you've gone in with the preconceived notion that is the film is about. The only one I can vaguely see is the Minotaur in the Maze.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's on purpose. No, not if it's on purpose. I don't think it's purposefully there to be a telling of the Minotaur in the Maze. I think it's there because it is a very famous myth. Because obviously in the book, Theseus, I want to say, gets chased through the maze by the Minotaur after promising King Midas that he would kill the Minotaur.
Yeah.
I think he's the third sacrifice as well, which would make sense because Danny would be the third child that were aware of who would die. He ends up killing the Minotaur.
Yeah.
In this case, Jack. So I can kind of see where that reference...
Yeah.
has been built from, and I do think it was on purpose, but I don't think it was purposeful to be like, oh, it's the Minotaur in the Maze. I think it's a very famous story, and it's a very interesting story.
Yeah.
And it works well in this kind of, if we have a maze, it would be cool to have him followed, and then have to, because it's been a really long time since I've read the myth of the Minotaur in the Maze, but I'm pretty sure in it, Theseus uses string.
Mm-hmm.
to guide himself back. The problem is people keep getting lost in there. The Minotaur finds them and kills them. That's why everyone keeps dying, because they can't find their way back out. So Theseus takes, I think it's the princess. It's Midas' daughter, gives him string.
Yeah.
To lead himself back out of the maze, which is what Danny does. He uses the footprints to find his way back out.
Yeah.
And Jack gets lost because there's no footprints for him to follow and ends up freezing to death. So I kind of get it, but I do just think that it has become, it's such a famous story and a very well-known story that it gets replicated in a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Because you put a maze in something, you've got to figure out a way for characters to get out of the maze. The fucking myth of the Minotaur, string, follow the footprints, mark crosses. Because they do that in the labyrinth. Sarah marks crosses to guide her back, and then the maze, then the labyrinth keeps moving, so she loses her way. So I do feel like it is very much just a, that myth is so famous, and it's like a smart way to find a way out of a labyrinth or a maze is to track your progress somehow.
So what I don't understand is they make reference, I think it's Barry Lyndon, the film that Stanley Kubrick makes before this, because they make reference to it in the Room 237. Mm. And they were saying, like, it was a very boring film, like, it was not very well regarded. And they were like, it was around this time. And they make mention of the fact that Stanley Kubrick has a 200 IQ, which I thought was very interesting that they were like,
he's got an IQ of 200, they were like, I've ever said.
They were like, this big brain motherfucker. And they were like, so basically he started reading this book. I think it's called like the Style of Seduction or the Art of Seduction. And it's all about like subliminal messaging. So it's like like how they used to like put like a glass of like lemonade on an advert, but then they would hide like the word sex inside the ice cubes so that people would be like more suggestive about buying it. And they were like, it was around this time that Kubrick started reading this book and learning more about that. And they were like, as a meticulous filmmaker, they were like, nothing in his films is by accident. It's all by design.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, so, and I was like, but what I don't understand now, and this is the part that my brain struggles with, is like, all of those people could be right. Every one of those things could be, if you're looking for it and you want to see it, all of those things could be referenced in that film. I'm not saying that they're not, and I'm not saying that those conspiracy theories are wrong. What I am saying is I don't understand why Stanley Kubrick would choose an adaptation of a novel that he's not even adapting that well to be the film that makes him go, haha, guys, I'm going to reveal all these secrets. That's the bit that doesn't make sense, because The Shining as a film, as a setup, and as a story doesn't really lend itself to referencing the Holocaust or genocide or, you know, all of these other things that people claim that it's about. Like, why would it be this film specifically? And to his credit, like, all of the people that made the documentary went, look, you know, this is done in conjunction, like, not in conjunction with the Kubrick estate. Like, we're not saying any of this is true. Like, we're not presenting any of it as fact. And Kubrick, to his credit, went to the grave without never answering any of these questions. Mm-hmm. Like, he never outwardly said that he did any of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the part that, like, people have mythologized this film to a point where people watch this film, study this film, pore over this film, meticulate this film, and have turned this film into a thing completely separate from, like, what it was intended to be, just for the sake of, like, having these conversations.
Mm.
And I just can't wrap my brain around, like, it being, you know, and there are filmmakers nowadays, I can think of three off the top of my head that do these kind of things. Jordan Peele hides things in his films, mm-hmm. very obviously. Christopher Nolan and David Fincher.
Mm-hmm.
They're all filmmakers that do this. They hide things in their films for people to find on repeat viewings and stuff like that. But I just cannot fathom Stanley Kubrick sitting down in a room and going, I'm going to make this fucking horror movie and I'm going to make it about this, this and this. And you know how I'm going to do it? In the most vague, tenuous ways possible.
Because
the thing is, it's four separate people over nine segments in this documentary talking about this. If it was so obvious and if it was so like out in the open, more people would be talking about this, right? More people would be having these discussions. Like, and I think in a weird way, it does a disservice to this. Like, I think The Shining is a great film. I think it's an extremely well-made horror movie that has been the source of many sleepless nights for me. And I think in its own right, it is a classic film based on that. However, I think having all of this extra baggage attached to it and having the man responsible for making it not be alive anymore to debunk or not debunk it means that this movie lives on in a sense of infamy that it doesn't deserve and isn't justified and takes away from its status as a classic movie on its own right by putting this albatross around its neck that it never asked for.
Mm.
And I just think it's wild that people think that this is what the movie's about. But one of the things that I will say before we finish our closing arguments, I am glad that Stephen King lessened his opinion on this film enough to allow Mike Flanagan, who is a god and is great and wonderful, and we know how much we love him on this podcast, to make the version
Mickey Flam.
To make the version of Dr. Sleep that he had to make. Because his version of Dr. Sleep not only is an adaptation of the 2013 source novel, but it also is a sequel to the original Shining book, and it exists in Kubrick's world and acts as a sequel to Kubrick's film as well. And initially when he pitched it to Stephen King, Stephen King went no, but then he went back with a second pitch and said, this is what I want to do. This is how it ties to Kubrick's film. This is how it ties to your original novel. And this is how it adapts the
current book.
And Stephen King said yes and signed off on it, gave the film his blessing, and has gone on to champion that film in like recent years. So I'm glad that there is that other part of it as well, where, you know, we get a sequel to it, and, you know, Mike Flanagan's film is fucking incredible. We are going to cover Dr. Sleep at some point, but I'm glad that that is allowed to exist alongside this. But what are your final thoughts and your score on The Shining?
Honestly, I think the further removed I get from watching this film, because it's been like 2 hours now?
A couple of hours, yeah.
The more plot holes I'm finding and the more annoyed I am by the sheer existence of this film. I get it, Stevie Babes. I fucking get it, alright? It's not a good film. Me and Stephen King have very little in common, but we both have our hatred of this film in common now. It's our bonding moment for me and Stephen King. I might even give his books another go after this. Which is, it happens once
every 5 years. I mean, you both have one thing in common.
I love Joe Hill.
No, I love you both unconditionally. And his book and you might be the only two objects that I would grab if the house is on fire.
Which one?
Needful Things, obviously, because it's my favourite Stephen King book.
Fair. I might give his work another go after watching this and agreeing with him on how poor this film is. I don't think I'd go for The Shining because it's pretty fucking big.
It's not that big. I have a paperback version of it.
I'll go have a look on the shelf when we get downstairs, and I'll pick a Stephen King book out, and I will give Stephen King another go. Purely because I sat through this, and I feel sorry for Stephen King that they made this film.
Oh no, crying into his millions in his gated house.
You know what, though? I feel sorry for Stephen King that they did this to his book.
Look what they did to my boy!
My boy! My son! quite literally as well in this case. I think it's a really... I think it's well shot, and I think the location is great. Because was this actually shot at the hotel?
Yeah.
So
location.
You didn't even find the hotel. Stephen King told you where he was staying when he wrote this, and you went, perfect, we'll get that place.
And they have like an Overlook Film Festival there. I don't know if it's every year, but it's quite frequent, because that's the footage of Ice Nine Kills doing the acoustic version of this comes from that festival. And when they premiered Dr. Sleep, they premiered it in this hotel, because James and Chelsea from Dead Meat have footage of it on their YouTube channel.
It was unnecessary to what I was saying, but thank you.
So,
like, he didn't even put the work into finding the location, because Stephen King told him where he was when he fucking wrote the book. Mm-hmm. Kubrick, what the fuck were you doing, man? Honest to God. No, I don't think it's very good. I think it's dreadfully boring. I think the jump in character behaviour happens way too suddenly with no build-up. I think long slogs go with nothing happening. I think the ending's fairly decent. But, as I said, the longer I'm thinking about it, the more plot holes I'm finding and the less sense it makes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a no from me. And if I could give it a minus, I would. Let's put it that way.
Wow.
I'm going to give it a flat bottom zero.
Shit. See, I love this film. And I feel like this is such a weird thing, because it's like, I always feel like, I always feel silly when we discuss films like this, because I'm like, yeah, man, this film scared the fucking shit out of me. And you're like, why? It's so boring. Like, I always feel like my my feelings are slightly, I don't want to say undermined, but I'm always like, is it me? But then I'm like, but then there are films that you like find scary that I don't find scary. But I'm like, I find it mad that this and The Exorcist, two of the like the films that terrified me the most as a child, and still like I still struggle now to watch The Exorcist. Whereas like I can watch The Shining, it has to be daylight. Like I can't watch this film at night. Like I'm not fucking out there watching this shit in the dark, and I ain't watching it before I go to bed. But like I can watch The Shining now, and it doesn't have, I don't think it has the same effect on me. Like, it didn't have the same effect on me, certainly this time, as it did the previous times when I've watched it.
Mm.
And I don't know if that's just because it's so far removed and my life is so far removed from where it was the last time I watched it. But I do think it is an effective film. I think if you take it as a film on its own, like, as a just a horror film made by Stanley Kubrick, like, I think it's a very well-made film. I do agree with you. I think that this movie, like, there is no, like, this movie just switches very quickly, and then it almost feels like it rushes towards the end. It feels like the end happens very quickly, without, you know, any sense of, like, change. I think the performances are great. I think Jack Nicholson is fucking fantastic in this movie. This is my second favourite role of his after The Joker. I think Shelley Duvall is brilliant in this. I mean, I don't think the role is as good as it could have been for her, but I do think the scenes towards the end where she's distressed and stressed out, probably are partly because she fucking is in real life and partly because she's a really fucking good actress. I think Danny Lloyd, the little kid who plays Danny, is great in this. And I think Scatman Crothers, for what he does, is good in this.
Yeah.
So I think across the board, the performances are great. I think it's a great looking film. There are some really good, like, from a technical standpoint, there are a couple of really well shot scenes in this. Mm-hmm. Where Kubrick uses a lot of interesting, like, camera stuff to disorientate the audience. But yeah, I think it's a great film. I've always thought it's a great film. It's just one of those films that I don't watch often because of the effect it has on me. But yeah, I would probably say on this viewing, I'm giving it a 4 out of 5. Normally I would give it a 4.5, but I think there's more stuff that I noticed this time that kind of made me go, it's a 4 for me.
I need to just mend mine slightly because I've just remembered something. I'm giving it a -1.
Okay.
It's getting a minus because my brain just reminded me that high-pitched fucking string noise every time they use The Shine.
Mm-hmm.
Grated so badly. And I know it was supposed to add atmosphere and make you feel a bit like disorientated. It's a bit
like a dog whistle, isn't it?
It just made my ears hurt. There was nothing disorientating around it. All it did was make me want to cover my ears and go la 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 la. And the problem is, people were also talking while this was happening, so I couldn't do that, otherwise I would miss dialogue. That could have helped make sense of this fucking movie. But yeah, no, I'm giving it. Do you know what? I was sat at Conan playing game. Maybe zero's harsh, because like you are right, Jack Nicholson.
You should give it at least 1 star just for the performances.
This was where my brain was going, and I was like, actually, like for performances and stuff, I should probably give it at least 1 because they are great. And then my brain went, yeah, that high pitched noise though, and I was like, yeah, I'd remove like 3 stars for that alone because it is really annoying. Which is why it's only a -1 and not a -3 because it did gain 2 points for how good the acting was, but then lost 3 points because of that high pitched squeal.
Nice.
It's like when they do the Hunger Games. I fucking hate that as well.
So that's our look at The Shining. What do you guys think of The Shining? Do you think it's overrated? Do you think it's underrated? One of the greatest horror movies of all time? One of the worst? Do you think it's about any of those things that people say that it's about? Let us know in the comments. Come find us on social media. SIMAHFpod on Twitter. So Mad a Horror Fan, all lowercase, all one word, Instagram and Tumblr. We will be back next week where we will be diving straight into our
next month.
Our next episode is on April Fool's Day. We will be diving straight into April with a look at Attack the Block from 2010.
Or will we? It's April Fool's Day, you never know.
So we will be back then. As always, stay spooky, stay safe, guys. Take care. Bye-bye.